I want to see the American people win. I want to see America win. I don't care if you're Democrat, Independent, Libertarian, Republican, bring me your ideas. And I will be an independent person who will embrace those ideas because I am not in any way in bed with a party.
Howard Schultz, former Starbucks CEO on 60 Minutes. He says he is seriously thinking of running for president as an independent, even though he's a self-proclaimed lifelong Democrat. Democrats say he would siphon votes away and help President Trump win re-election. Aaron Blake is senior political reporter for The Washington Post's political analysis blog called The Fix. He's here to tell us more. Hi, Aaron.
Hi.
Well, does he have any experience at all in the political world?
Traditionally speaking, no. This is a man who comes very much from the business world, where he was very successful with Starbucks and built a big fortune for himself, but only really seemed to get involved in politics, at least on a personal level, in the last couple of years when he left Starbucks, started giving speeches and really kind of testing out a very political sounding message that now he sounds like he may want to employ in an independent centrist political campaign.
Right. And so he has a book out, which it seems like almost every presidential candidate needs to have a book out first. So he's got that out this week. And has he done anything else, like hired some fancy publicists or pollsters or analysts, strategists?
Yeah, it seems like he's pretty serious about it. The staffing aspect of it, when you're an independent candidate, you need to do a lot of things to get on the ballots, which is something that the major party nominees get to take for granted because they win a nomination and they're already on the ballot. As an independent, you really have to have a lot of resources to get the number of signatures that you need. Each state has different rules, and some of them are very, very difficult. Judging by what we're hearing, he is putting together a real operation, at least relative to other independent candidates, because he would really have to if he were going to have any real shot at winning the president as an independent candidate.
Yeah. And how much money does he have to spend? Would this be entirely self-financed?
I would guess that it would be mostly self-financed. One, because it's very difficult to raise money as an independent candidate. And two, because he is a man of tremendous means. A billionaire by pretty much any standard. The question with those kinds of candidates, of course, is generally speaking, how much of that is liquid? How much of that can they actually pull out and put towards a campaign and still have enough liquid to do the other things they might want to do with their money business-wise? So, the short answer is that we don't really know exactly what he has or what he'd be able to spend. But I think if you're looking at independent candidates who actually could put some of their own money towards a campaign and really give themselves a shot at getting that ballot access and getting known to the American people, he would certainly be very high on that list of people who would fit that bill.
So we have seen other billionaires either flirt with or actually run as a third party candidate. Michael Bloomberg, for one, thought about it and then realized, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be a Democrat if I run. And also, of course, Ross Perot, who ran twice in the 90s, obviously didn't win. What was his effect on those races?
Well, certainly Ross Perot is the guiding light here, or the person who you would look at and say there is a chance that Howard Schultz could have an impact on this race and could even do pretty well. There was a time back in the 90s when Ross Perot was running that he was actually polling ahead of George Bush and Bill Clinton. Of course, that fell apart rather quickly. He faced a lot of scrutiny for his views and for his past, which he did not seem particularly prepared to deal with, and neither was his campaign. He wound up dropping out and then getting back in later. And I think that's a little bit instructive here. Part of the problem with being an independent candidate is the institutional problems that exist with getting on the ballot, with raising money, with having the kind of shot that you would if you were a major party nominee. But something else that we've seen over the course of American history is that independent candidates, whether at the presidential level or at the Senate or congressional level, an even bigger problem, I'd argue, is that oftentimes they just don't have the kind of political wherewithal to put up with that scrutiny. So even if they do begin to catch on, it's difficult for that to sustain the momentum. And so, for Howard Schultz, the big question going into it is whether he can raise his polls enough, maybe get into those debates, which require 15% of the polls. And then from there, being able to actually kind of legitimize himself as a real contender, somebody who doesn't just fold the moment that people start really looking into their background.
Right. And this seems to be his lead issue. I'll play a clip of tape from the interview from 60 Minutes last night. This is what he pointed to, the national debt, as the main reason he decided to run.
I look at both parties. We see extremes on both sides. Well, we are sitting today with approximately $21.5 trillion of debt, which is a reckless example, not only of Republicans, but of Democrats as well, as a reckless failure of their constitutional responsibility.
Okay, the national debt, not really an issue that's getting a ton of attention now on either side. Is that really wise to lead with that?
Yeah, I share your skepticism about that. This is something that is used with great effect in Republican primaries from time to time, of course. This was a big issue for the Tea Party when it rose to prominence. But we don't see, even as the debt has risen significantly under President Trump, we don't see the Republican Party being as concerned about it as it was a decade ago when Democrats were in charge. I think, if anything, this is an effort by Howard Schultz, who is a longtime Democrat, to maybe try and find a way into getting at disaffected Republicans and people who might warm to that kind of a message. Otherwise, his campaign would seem very much geared towards traditional Democrats. But exactly how appealing that message is to those disaffected Republicans or potentially disaffected Republicans, I don't think there's much in the polling right now that suggests people are really clamoring for that kind of a campaign at this point.
So Democrats are pretty much not into this announcement by Howard Schultz that he's exploring a third party run. So the idea, the common wisdom would be that he would siphon Democratic votes away, not Republican votes away.
Yeah, and I should emphasize that the reaction to this has very much been from the activist level and the more liberal elements. Social media is where we gauge this stuff initially, and of course that's dominated by people who tend to be more politically partisan and more activist. They are certainly very much opposed to this, as you would understand how they would be, because this does have the possibility of splitting the Democratic vote. Right now, if you look at the 2020 election, look at the president's numbers, if Democrats were to just put up a candidate who kind of was a, 50% approval, 50% disapproval, that person would very likely be favored to win this election. So adding Howard Schultz into the mix at the least is an unnecessary variable who could, change things up in a way that maybe Democrats don't want. But, the even worse thing here is that he is a Democrat who most of his issue positions fit very well with that party. And so you would think that, at least logically speaking, he would have a lot of appeal to certain elements of the Democratic Party, especially if the party nominates a more liberal candidate, which at this point seems to be the direction in which things might be headed.
Aaron Blake, senior political reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, our legal is here to tell us what would happen if Howard Schultz is successful, gets enough votes, but none of the candidates gets enough electoral college votes to win the presidency. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Okay, we just talked about former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz possibly running for president as an independent. Well, what if he did and did well enough to win a bunch of electoral college votes? And let's say none of the three candidates reached the 270 threshold to win the presidency. Well, It's Monday, so that means our legal eagle, Jessica Levinson, is here. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and also an election law specialist, so the perfect person to answer that question. Hi, Jessica.
Way to set expectations too high. Hello.
Hi. Never too high for the legal eagle. Okay, what happens if no one gets 270?
So if no candidate hits 270, then we go to the 12th Amendment. And what that says is the House of Representatives picks the president from the top three electoral vote getters. But the kind of caveat there is that each state delegation has only one vote. So this has happened actually only one time in our nation's history, in 1824, where the House of Representatives voted for John Quincy Adams. He actually won in the House and he became president and was victorious over Andrew Jackson, who had actually gotten more votes in the Electoral College.
Okay, so even though the Democrats are in the majority in the House, it would just be down to a count of how many red states and blue states there are?
So it would be down to each state's House delegation to vote on their own for who are we going to pick. So yes, you would look at, in terms of state by state, is their House delegation red or is their House delegation blue?
Okay, so before any of that happens, Howard Schultz would need to get on the ballot in every state. And that is really the most difficult part of running as a third party candidate, right? Because there's no party apparatus that automatically puts you on the ballot. You have to do different things in pretty much every state, right, to get on the ballot?
This is like the quintessential muddled morass of election law. So this deals with state ballot access laws. It varies state by state. It is, and the requirements are anything from filing fees to a number of petitions. As you said, practically speaking, it's really difficult because, and we've actually seen this for people who run as no party preference in California, you don't have the political support. You don't have the fundraising apparatus behind you. You don't have a political party who's going to nominate you. It's really hard to gain traction as a third party. If you can, and then you go on to the election in at least some key states, then I think the real political question becomes, whose votes are you taking? Are you taking the Democratic votes? Or are you taking the Republicans' votes?
Okay, let's switch to another big story in the news. The state of California is suing the city of Huntington Beach, Surf City, over what it says is the city's refusal to build enough homes for its growing population, enough affordable housing. So on what grounds can the state sue a city for not building enough homes and creating more affordable housing?
Yeah, so there's actually a state law that requires that all cities and all counties set aside a certain percentage of their new developments for either moderate and low income housing. And there are currently, estimates are 52 cities and counties who are out of compliance with these state housing requirements. And Huntington Beach actually has a fairly lengthy history of being out of compliance, where just a few years ago, their city council basically said, we're going to reduce the number of houses that are available under certain zoning codes, which essentially put them out of compliance with the state law. There was a suit against Huntington Beach by some affordable housing advocates. They lost for kind of a weird procedural reason, but since then, the state has actually amended its law. That law just went into effect January 1st, and it gives the state more power to sue regardless of what kind of city you are and say, you cannot, as a city council, vote your way out of the state law. You have to provide a certain number of low and moderate income housing units. And the suit really shows, I think, how serious Gavin Newsom is about trying to further his goal of more affordable housing.
But lots of cities don't abide by this rule, by these laws, kind of skate around it. Why Huntington Beach? Why is it being singled out, do you think?
Well, I think in part Huntington Beach because their city council basically took a step of voting them out of compliance. Like once they had a state-approved plan, I think what happened about 4 years ago is that the city then reduced the number of housing units available, and they've already litigated this issue. And so in that way, Huntington Beach is kind of ripe as being, one, a high-profile offender and ripe for using this new, more robust law. I also think that Huntington Beach is obviously a very wealthy area, and what Gavin Newsom can do with the help of Attorney General Becerra is basically send a message saying, whoever you are, you have to comply with these housing codes, with these provisions. And so I think that you don't have to sue every locality right off the bat. You can pick a few and make them basically your test cases, and also send a message to everybody else that if you don't comply, you're going to be on the receiving end of a lawsuit, just like Huntington Beach.
All right. Finally, we have just a few moments for you to weigh in on this very important topic. So I'm sorry I'm throwing this at you. The Supreme Court is going to take up a gun rights case next term. How significant is that? They haven't really looked at gun rights in a long time.
Yeah, the Supreme Court has not looked at gun rights in about 10 years. And 10 years ago is when the Supreme Court said for the first time, there's an individual right to bear arms. And believe it or not, before that, we weren't sure if it was a person's right or if it was the state's right to create a militia. Now, since then, the Supreme Court really has not said anything. Now, this case that the court is going to hear, not this term, but next term, deals with a really big open question, which is, do you have a right to carry a gun in public? You know, the case deals with a New York City law that basically says if you have a premises license, then the only places you can have your gun, loaded or unloaded, locked or unlocked, is either in your home or in seven specific kind of shooting ranges in the city of New York. And so this is interesting because, one, it will tell us what's permissible in terms of carrying guns in public, but two, it's going to give us a great indication of what our current Supreme Court is thinking about the Second Amendment.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Monday League Legal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, when journalist Jason Rezaian was arrested and thrown into one of Iran's toughest prisons, his captors told him they had proof he was a spy, a Kickstarter campaign he had started called the Iranian Avocado Quest.
Iranians, like everybody else, like avocados. You meet Iranians, they'll tell you that in their home country that you can grow almost anything. You could definitely grow avocados there, and I wanted to know why there were none.
The story of Rezaian's long imprisonment and how he got out, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In 2014, Anthony Bourdain took his travel docuseries Parts Unknown to a country that had been largely closed off from most of the world for decades.
After all this time, I finally had my chance to see a country I'd heard so much about.
The weather's nice, too. I don't know what I was expecting, but it's nice.
A big blank spot on nearly every traveler's resume.
Merci. Delicious.
That country was Iran, and his hosts for part of that episode were American-born Washington Post correspondent Jason Rezaian and his Iranian wife, also a journalist. Her name is Yeji Rezaian. And at the time, Iran was negotiating the nuclear deal with the United States and other major countries. The Rezaians were hopeful for Iran's future.
I love it, and I hate it, you know, but it's home. It's become home.
Are you optimistic about the future?
Yeah, especially if this nuclear deal finally happens. Yeah, very much, actually.
But 6 weeks after filming that episode, Jason and Yeji were arrested. They were blindfolded and taken to Tehran's notorious Evin prison. Yeji was there for 2.5 months, but Jason ended up spending nearly a year and a half there. He became a pawn in the nuclear deal negotiations between the United States and Iran. He writes about his ordeal in a new book. It's called Prisoner, My 544 Days in an Iranian Prison, Solitary Confinement, a Sham Trial, High Stakes Diplomacy, and the Extraordinary Efforts It Took to Get Me Out. And Jason Rezaian joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks, Madeline. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. Okay, so it was 2014 when you were arrested, and you were basically just going out to a birthday dinner with your wife, and you were stopped at gunpoint in the elevator of your building. Did you know right then that this was what you had been thinking could happen to you and was finally happening, that you were being arrested?
Look, as someone who was working in Iran for a long time, I always sort of knew that this could happen. I just never thought that it would happen. You make that calculation in your mind when you move to a place like Iran that's got a track record of imprisoning journalists, and you think that if you play by the rules and follow them closely and are transparent in your activities, nothing like this is ever going to happen. But it did. But I have to say, you know, that first night and those first days, I never expected that it would drag on this way. There were so many twists and turns in the whole ordeal. But in the first few days, I was certain that it would end more quickly. I never thought that it would get to a point where I'd be put on trial and I was, you know, openly being accused of really egregious national security crimes and threatened with execution publicly and in my interrogation room. So, yes, I knew it could happen. No, I didn't think it would.
Hmm. Initially, what did they accuse you of?
Initially, they said that I was the station chief of the CIA in Tehran, and their proof of that was references to a Kickstarter project in which I said that I was trying to bring avocados to Iran. It was sort of a fun project that I had put up online several years earlier. I failed spectacularly in raising the funds that I wanted to get this enterprise off the ground. But they were certain that this was code name, you know, code word for something much more nefarious.
But it actually was a plan to bring avocados to Iran.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, you're in Southern California. You're around a lot of Iranians.
Yeah.
Iranians, like everybody else, like avocados. You meet Iranians, they'll tell you that in their home country that you can grow almost anything. You could definitely grow avocados there. And I wanted to know why there were none. And, you know, this was a sort of had a point behind it. Iran is perceived to be isolated from the rest of the world, the subject of sanctions for decades, cut off from information for, you know, a long time, not anymore, but, you know, it wasn't something that sunk into their consciousness. You know, Iranians aren't waking up every morning and going to brunch on the weekends and having avocado toast. So I thought to myself, why is that? Let's kind of interrogate this a little bit and explore it in a way that might potentially lead to some larger points. It was kind of esoteric and definitely not the sort of thing that my interrogators could wrap their head around.
Also, the idea of Kickstarter.
Kickstarter. I mean, like, why would anybody give money to people that they don't know for projects that are meaningless?
Well, actually, that does make sense.
That makes sense.
So the guy who said that, his name is Kazem.
Yeah.
And he was your primary interrogator. Describe him. What was he like?
You know, I think he was my ideological opposite. I'm not somebody who prescribes to any specific ideology, but I believe that people should be free to live the lives that they want to, think about what they want to, consume the information, products, and opportunities that they want to, and nobody should get in each other's way. He believed something very different from that, that, you know, we need to control this society. We need to control our fellow Iranians' access to information, their ability to connect with the rest of the world, and that ultimately, you know, Iran will be better served if it's cut off from the rest of the world.
And yet, as you say, he's really captivated by American pop culture. He wants Will Smith to play him in the movie made of this whole ordeal.
Yeah. Look, I mean, that's a common theme in interactions with Iranians. Even the ones that profess a commitment or a love for the regime, there's an attraction, a seduction, you know, a wanting to know life beyond Iran's borders. And I think that that's something that happens in every country.
So he has you write down all of these stories and anecdotes and, you know, places you've been, and you end up writing a lot down and talking to him for days and days and days and hours and hours and hours. And do you think at the end he really did believe that you were this CIA station chief bent on undermining Iran? Or did he think that this was all a misunderstanding as well?
I think that on a certain level, the interrogators that I dealt with have to believe that anybody that's from the outside and living and working in Iran is a threat by virtue of their existence. But did he believe that I was doing the things that he said that I was doing, or that they thought that they could sort of extrapolate from my emails? I kind of doubt it highly, because as unsophisticated as he was, I don't think he was that stupid to think that I'd actually done anything wrong.
There were a lot of interactions on a very high level between the Iranian foreign minister and various journalists and John Kerry at the time about you. So it could have, the order could have been given from higher than Kazem to release you.
Oh, it certainly was. You know, he wasn't the, as he referred to himself, the top banana in my ordeal. I mean, there were other people involved at much bigger, higher levels.
But for some reason, they declined to issue the order. At what point did you think that this was about something bigger than you, that you were being used in these nuclear negotiations?
I couldn't see it until I came out of solitary. And that was 7 weeks into my ordeal. But then the access, sort of naturally, when you come out of isolation, complete isolation, and you're around people, and they recognize you, I'm talking about my guards, recognize you and refer to things that are being said about you in public discourse, whether it's Iranian discourse or satellite television that they have access to, I started to understand, okay, this is bigger than, you know, me just being swept up into a case of, you know, a big mistake. This is part of a larger set of issues. And, you know, it took some months to really realize, okay, I'm in the middle of a geopolitical hurricane, and you know, my fate is going to be tied up with that.
And so then you have to be, then you have to go on trial, and this is as you say in the title, it's a sham trial.
Right?
Can you describe the judge? I think you don't have many good words to say about him in your book.
Well, so the judge is a guy named Abul Ghassem Salavati. If you look up the name Salavati, Judge Salavati, he's referred to interchangeably as the judge of death or the hanging judge. He signed the execution orders of hundreds of prisoners in Iran. The trial was ridiculous from the get-go. And, you know, I think had they put me on trial in the opening weeks and months when I was in solitary or just afterwards, I might have gone up to the witness stand and pled guilty, which is what they were trying to get me to do that whole time. But by the time I went on trial, the trial started 10 months after my arrest, I realized that this was a ridiculous process, and everybody is trying to, you know, is playing a role here. And if I go up there and plead guilty, there is a chance that they might pardon me a few days later or months later, but that would be something that I'd have to live with for the rest of my life. And it wasn't something that I was going to do. My wife was very adamant about the fact that, you know, as two people that haven't done anything wrong, but have had this massive campaign, propaganda campaign, sort of hurled at us, denied our opportunity to speak publicly, defend ourselves, and answer to these accusations, there's no way you're going to get up on the witness stand and plead guilty. You're not doing that. And so, you know, I thought to myself, do I listen to my captor or do I listen to my wife? And guys, I will tell you, it's always better to listen to your wife than your captor.
Especially because she's Iranian and she knows the society inside and out, and also a journalist, and also incredibly dogged in trying to get you free, get you out. She develops a source within the government who's giving her accurate information about what's going to happen to you. Was that a lifeline for you?
Look, she did not want to allude to those things when we would see each other very much. You know, she said, told me things in very veiled ways so that if we were being listened to, which we were almost certainly, having our meetings, our infrequent meetings, surveilled. But yeah, it was an incredible lifeline. She was my lifeline. She was a rock, and my family, my mother and my brother here in the U.S. did everything they could to keep my name in the public spotlight. And, you know, they were incredibly successful at it. But they were doing it right here in the United States of America. My wife was doing it on her own in Iran, in a country where, you know, women are not granted the same rights as men, first of all. And second, you know, she had a husband in prison And I think, you know, she, I say that she's got a big S, you know, on her shirt underneath her chador in those pictures because she was really playing Superwoman at that point.
Do you think, looking back on it now, it all had to do with the nuclear negotiations, or did they figure this out later after you'd been arrested?
No, I think it did. I mean, I think the forces within the Iranian, the Revolutionary Guard Corps that took me, their intent was to do something that would get in the way of President Rouhani's outreach to the U.S. And vice versa. It wasn't the only thing that they did, but, you know, they were really trying to scuttle this deal before it happened. And it didn't really work because Rouhani didn't play ball, right? He distanced himself from me and my arrest immediately. His foreign minister consistently sort of implied my guilt in these crimes that didn't really exist. And it was a complicated situation that I think spiraled out of everybody's control and then ultimately became such a well-known case and one that there was so much outrage over that the Obama administration had to do something to end it. And, you know, I think if you look back at the moment of the deal, there was a lot of dissent publicly and, you know, within the government in Congress over the nuclear deal. And so it gave, you know, the return of Americans from Iran, it was a nice headline that day.
Mm-hmm. So you're Iranian-American. Your dad was Iranian. Your wife is Iranian. You are not allowed to go back to Iran.
I think I'd be allowed to go back. I just don't think I'd be allowed to leave. So I'm not going to risk it anytime soon.
Yeah. How do you feel about that? Do you miss it?
Yeah, tremendously. I'm very sad about it. I'm more sad for my wife because she lived her entire life there and then, you know, one morning told very abruptly that she was getting on a plane and leaving her home forever. Her parents are still there. And, you know, it's a great, great wound that they've inflicted on she and me and our families. So I'm very sad about it. I miss the place. I miss my friends there. I miss the life that she and I were building there. And I don't think that there's an opportunity to go back anytime soon. And if and when we're able to go back one day, it will be undoubtedly to a very different experience.
Well, Jason, it's been a great pleasure speaking with you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. That's Jason Rezaian. His memoir is called Prisoner, My 544 Days in an Iranian Prison, Solitary Confinement, a Sham Trial, High Stakes Diplomacy, and the Extraordinary Efforts It Took to Get Me Out. He will be in conversation this Thursday with Maz Jobrani, the comedian, at Live Talks Los Angeles. It's at the New Road School in Santa Monica at 8 o'clock. Coming up, new music. KCRW DJ Aaron Bird is here to share some of his discoveries. Don't go anywhere. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Monday, and that's when we talk about new music with our own KCRW DJs. I'm joined today by Aaron Bird, and he's brought an eclectic batch of stuff for us to listen to, from French-Canadian electronica to East African and Parisian DJs, Long Island chillwave. Hi.
Hey, how's it going, Madam?
That's such the gamut.
Well, that's what we like to do. It is eclectic, right?
Absolutely. Okay, well, let's begin with Marie Davidson. Okay, so that sounds like something you'd hear not at this time of day, but way later.
No, it reminds me of a very specific time of day in a very specific location, perhaps with some extracurriculars.
Okay, tell us about her.
So she is from Montreal, French-Canadian producer. She actually teamed up with an Italian DJ and producer named La Musa II for this particular tune. She dropped out of school when she was like 19, though she was classically trained as a violinist for about 6 years, but now sort of more claims to be a self-taught electronic producer. And this song describes the scene, and you picked it up, of an early morning on a dance floor at a club.
Uh-huh.
In the very beginning, she talks about how it's 6 a.m. and she's in New York. The song actually reminds me of this moment. There's this very famous club in Germany called the Berghain.
Yeah.
And are you familiar with it?
Of course.
Yeah. So
I mean, not intimately. Just I've heard of
Let
it.
Let me just put that caveat up there. Yeah, so I went there about 6-7 years ago, and it's and for those in the audience that aren't familiar with it, it's pretty much a late night club. So you show up around midnight, usually closer to 2 a.m. Mm-hmm. on a Friday. And I remember distinctly, I went by myself, and I went, and it was in the dead of winter, so I went to go check my coat, and I saw several people with duffel bags. I later find out that the duffel bags were full of their clothes for work on Monday.
No. So yeah. They were in the club for the whole weekend.
They were in the club for the whole weekend, yeah. And this song reminds me of a moment that you typically will have at Berghain when you know you've probably been in there way too long, but the wave
you know
is
you're not going to have a productive Monday.
No, you're probably not going to have a productive Monday, but the wave is already crest, so you just keep on going along with it.
L'extase. À New York, à 6 heures du matin, je m'amuse, la sueur sur son front, le lever du soleil sur ses paupières, à l'essai del mattino, mi diverto, comment, à l'essai del mattino, mi diverto.
And so that song is called L'Extase, and she just came out with an album a couple of months ago, and many people who are familiar with her music may know her as a producer and DJ and writer who satirizes the entire sort of club scene and club culture. It's a really interesting mix because she's obviously making dance music, mm-hmm. but if you really dissect and listen to what she's talking about, she's sort of poking fun at the whole culture.
Okay, so that's Marie Davidson and L'Extase. Next up, we have EA Wave, and they're from Nairobi. Tell us about them.
Yeah, so EA Wave, the EA actually stands for East Africa, and they're a group of DJs and producers from Nairobi. And they're made up of 5 members, and they're sort of like a superhero group of sorts, just for music. So they're led by this guy named Jinku, who is considered the groove. He mixes psychedelic dance music with polyrhythmic African percussion. Ukweli is the one responsible for sort of incorporating the melody, and he's in charge of handpicking the right vocalists for the songs and stripped down tracks. He's heavily influenced by R&B, indie pop, and rock. There's Harabe, who is considered the soul. He blends his first love jazz with EDM, lo-fi, and hip-hop. There's New Funk. He brings what's considered the bounce. He provides the groovy samples and the funk-laced beats. And then finally, there's Shikanji, who is the king of low-end. He incorporates the future bass, the 808s, the heavy drums. And that's something that you hear in this particular song, Alango.
Alango, she don't climb big. Alango, she wants a motor car. She don't go to the river. Alango, she wants a bathtub. Alango, she a picky picky, she a witty witty, a girl to do. Moto, a boda boda, pico, kada, she want to go. Alango, Alango, ma. Alango, Alango, ma. Alango, Alango, ma. Alango, ma.
Just briefly to mention something about EA Wave. So over the last few years, there's been an incredible scene burgeoning out of Nairobi, and this collective has been the pioneers of what they call New Nairobi, and their whole goal is to challenge and disrupt the current idea of what East African music should sound like.
Huh.
Yeah, and that's their whole plan and goal and the whole
because
purpose.
What did it sound like? What are they challenging? What is that sound that they're...
I think the truth of the matter is when you were to, if you were to say to anybody, oh, it's a Kenyan group or mm-hmm. it's Kenyan music, at least from an American perspective, I think most people are automatically transported to this idea of whatever they deem a traditional sound. Uh-huh. And as you can hear from Alango, there's parts and aspects of traditional music in there, but it definitely
sounds
much more contemporary.
Definitely sounds African to me.
For sure.
Yeah, right. But you're right, with that contemporary vibe.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Okay, moving on to Kitty Smile. What's Kitty Smile? Who's Kitty Smile?
Kitty Smile is a gay Parisian DJ, producer, singer, dancer, fashion provocateur.
So it's one person.
It's one person.
Okay.
Yeah. But he incorporates all these things. He has a really impressive story, actually. He was raised by a single mother who was the first generation Cameroonian. And he described growing up as being Black, Arabic, and poor. He started taking dance lessons as a kid to sort of escape the traps of low-income neighborhoods. And through that, he discovered artists like Grace Jones and LA's very own Sylvester, actually, both flamboyant, androgynous artists that he really found an affinity for. And pursuing this path of music and dance eventually led him to meeting Lissandra Ninja, who is considered the godmother of Vogue in France. And of course, voguing is this highly stylized dance scene and really a community invented by queer people of color in New York in the late 80s. And
that is the influence on Kitty Smile?
That's the influence on Kitty Smile. And so he began DJing and walking the runway, and it continued to allow him to be more comfortable in his skin. And he found that voguing and the whole ballroom scene was really a place of radical acceptance. And this realization really inspired him to become an evangelist through the music, to be honest. Lest you have a song like House of God.
This is a new day you have given us. May we begin again and we commit ourselves to removing obstacles when and where we find them. In state houses, in prisons, in offices, on mountaintops, and in classrooms, in locker rooms, and in churches.
I only wish I could see him, because I bet he looks incredible.
He looks fabulous, I gotta say. Oh. Yeah, you should check it out.
Okay.
And his videos are amazing.
All right, let's go to River Spirit. This is a trio from Detroit. Tell us more about them.
Yeah, so there isn't much info out there about them. This is their debut album. They're actually a recent discovery. I just really dig their sound and think they have a lot of potential. They're doing something really interesting musically. Though they aren't quite as polished, they remind me of a band that many KCRW listeners may be familiar with out of Australia called Hiatus Coyote. They have this unique ability to create a really striking balance between fairly traditional melodic structures. There's unexpected chord changes, really compelling time signatures, and they have these rich sonic textures. It's really impressive for a young band, in particular considering that they're only a trio.
That's River Spirit and the single Me, I Fall. Finally, we have Mr. Twin Sister. Is that a group, a person?
Yeah, it's a
group. Or twins?
How about D, none of the above? they are a quartet based in New York, originally from Long Island. And some people may know them as simply just Twin Sister. They now go by Mr. Twin Sister. Don't know why, but so be it.
But why not?
Why not? Yeah. This song, Set Me Free, is from their third album called Salt. And you can hear they're clearly influenced by the like avant-pop era of the early mid-90s with bands like Portishead and Chibo Mato and Kaktu Twins and Stereolab. You hear all of that in their album.
My life is a tight noose that I tighten every day. Getting deeper, deeper in my head.
Okay, not only does it sound like Portishead, it sounds like Sade.
Yeah, yeah, they have all that going on.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm listening to it in my headphones now, and let me just say, it's such a true privilege being a KCRW DJ, because outside of FCC rules, the only limitations we have is just access to recorded music. Uh-huh. And I personally think of my show as a time on air and a moment to share music that not only sounds good, but also feels good. And so I'm on this never-ending quest for attractive sounds. And every couple of months, I have these moments where I discover what I like to call, and you'll hear me say it on air sometimes, is like my most recent obsessions. And this song, Set Me Free, is one of my most recent obsessions. I love this song. It just sounds so good and just feels so good.
Well, thank you very, very much for coming by and sharing these obsessions with us.
Thank you.
KCRW DJ Aaron Bird, you can hear him Friday nights, midnight to 3 a.m., or check him out anytime by downloading our KCRW app and listening to his show.
For the heat death to descend, will I feel a chill in the night? That the last star's last light, them stand out there.
Mr. Twin Sister, in case you need another reminder about who that group is. Hi, Christian Bordahl.
Hey there, Madeline Brand. How do you like Mr. Twin Sister?
I really like them.
I do too.
I especially like the name.
It's really sweet, and I think you're absolutely right about the Sade reference. She really sounds like her. Anyway, earlier today you talked about Mr. Howard Schultz, former Starbucks CEO, seriously considering an independent run for the presidency in 2020. Generally, I would say reactions were not terribly favorable to that idea. Evan Miller says personally, no, many of the problems facing my generation, student loan debt, unaffordable housing, high healthcare costs, are problems the free market made worse. I've always liked Schultz for giving part-time Starbucks staff healthcare and college tuition, but we don't need another CEO as president. GU says he's looking to be the next Ross Perot. Scott Jones says don't be a nader. Both examples, of course, of third-party candidates who help tilt elections. And I think a number of people were concerned about that Howard Schultz would end up doing the same kind of thing
right.
for Donald Trump
exactly.
in 2020. Yeah.
Being another Jill Stein.
Exactly. Theodore Arachiga, however, says Howard's a good dude. Working for Starbucks comes with many perks and benefits that many other jobs don't and would never offer, starting with a decent wage way above the minimum wage. Edward Madsen says, pass. Just because you have expertise in one domain does not mean that you have it in another. His money has clouded his thinking. If he really wanted to make an impact, he'd be better off bankrolling a new national third party than running himself as a vanity candidate that won't win. So
not a lot of love.
Not a whole lot of love for Howard Schultz, although many people appreciate what he's done at Starbucks in terms of, you know, being supportive of some of the workers.
Right. Okay. Well, we'll see. There's certainly no shortage of candidates in the mix.
No
so
way.
We'll hear from a lot of them. Thank you, Christian Bordahl. And thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.